On today's episode, I'm answering your questions on another Q&A. Welcome to the podcast helping you train, rehab, and run smarter. When I first started running in my 20s, I knew it would be something I'd be passionate about for the rest of my life. But unfortunately, developing injury after injury disrupted my progress and left me undertrained at the start line on race day. Even with my knowledge as a physio, I still fell victim to the vicious injury cycle, and when searching for answers, struggled to decipher between common running myths and evidence-based guidance. That's what this podcast is here to help you with. So, join me as a Run Smarter scholar, and let's break the injury cycle by raising your running IQ and achieving running feats you never thought possible. Welcome back, Run Smarter Scholars. I haven't done one of these episodes for a while, and I love answering your questions. It's just sometimes the run sheet gets quite long. I usually have, you know, 2 months, sometimes longer, of a run-up with ideas and guests and, you know, reruns and those sorts of things that pop up, that sometimes the Q&As fall by the wayside a little bit, and it's been a while. I'm like, you know what, let's just get it done. So I pushed it ahead, pushed it to the front of the list, and this week and next week we'll be answering your questions that you've submitted. It has been a little bit tricky trying to decide which questions we do put in. Sorry if I haven't got to your question. If you have submitted it, you might be on next week's episode. So don't be too discouraged if it hasn't been in this episode. Usually I like to encourage or like pick the ones that have come in earlier, like the early bird gets the worm with these sort of things. So the sooner the better. But also if I've found some questions that have a sort of common theme, I'll try to squeeze them together as sort of help the flow of the episode. But also a lot of the questions that come in are around help with a certain injury or help with a certain diagnosis. And you know, there's a reason on certain podcasts and YouTube channels and TV shows and that sort of stuff, they like to say at the start, they have the sort of medical disclaimer at the start saying, you know, this is passed as just general advice and shouldn't be replaced as shouldn't be in replaced to medical advice from your practitioner, or if you know, just sort of constitutes as just general sort of advice, don't sort of replace this as a health professional. And there's a reason for that, because when someone submits a question saying, I have pain in my foot that's been going on for several weeks, these are the symptoms, these are the characteristics, what is it? Or, you know, a question similar to that effect. It's very hard for me to try to put that into an episode and try to help with that scenario, because it is hard to diagnose. You do need more information. You do need to go through a thorough assessment. And the last thing I'd want to do is give someone the wrong advice based on the limited information I have. But at the same time, like, I do recognize that the types of questions that do come in are more surrounded by injuries, because it's those people, if they're currently injured, they're the ones looking for the answers the most. And it's just what gets filtered down. Who has the... where's the motivations come from to post a question? And usually it's the ones who are injured that are the highest of the list. Whereas when things are going really well and everything's falling into place, you know, if that's you, you're probably not really compelled to submit a question because everything's going well. So I do recognize that as well. So I have left some in, and others it's been a bit more challenging to put into the episode list. But nonetheless, hopefully I try to answer these questions so to help you, to help everyone, not just someone who does have low back pain, but to help everyone kind of understand, maybe prevent injuries or help you just run smarter in general. Hopefully these are the advice I give, no matter what the question, sort of helps you and your understanding. So the first question comes in from Rachel, who was the first to submit a question. So she gets priority here and answering it first and foremost. Rachel says, every one of my runs nowadays has hills. Assuming this is a good thing, but I'm getting more fatigued. on some runs, I'm needing more shorter 5K runs between my longer runs. Your thoughts on what I need to toughen up or what I need to do to toughen up? This is a very similar situation to me, Rachel, because where I live, I've lived here for a good 2 years now, and it's quite hilly. I live on a hill, and if I want to run down to this lovely parkland that I have, it's about 400 meters or so straight downhill. And then if I want to venture out further away from the park, it's going to be hills. And on my way back, it has to be uphill. And so while it's not mountainous or that strenuous, like it was more than what I was used to. And it has to be every one of my runs unless I want to drive somewhere or do something. But I do recognize that a lot of people live in hilly areas and they don't want to have to drive to go for runs for every single run that they have. So I feel you. I feel your situation, particularly now if your body's sort of responding, saying it's getting a bit more fatigued. So I will try to advise as best I can. You can continue with the hills, but you might want to spend maybe 1 or 2 days doing deliberate hill training because you want to get stronger with the hills. You want your body to adapt to the hills. So let's spend 1 or 2 days per week being very deliberate, saying, okay, let me try to challenge my capabilities and challenge these my body to these hills and see if we can, you know, reach or hit your adaptation zone, and therefore you get stronger to that particular stimulus or that particular terrain or environment, etc. But then we have those other days where it's sort of like your easy runs where we don't really want to challenge you to the hills, then we really need to back off. Really need to, when it comes to the hills, go really easy up those hills, even walk. Heaven forbid people like, I have to walk up hills. Well, maybe you do have to for a couple of weeks, especially while your body's showing you signs of overload or signs of doing too much. So walking the hills. First of all, you could probably choose a segment of your run that has slightly less hills than others. And then when it does come to those hills, maybe just be a bit more patient, either do a really slow jog up them or just do some walk jog kind of segments up that hill as well. You can use RPE as your metric of choice, or you could, if you have a good GPS with a good accurate current pace, you can assign sort of how fast you want to go up that hill. So for me, it might be like a 6.5 minute per kilometer pace, or like a 10 or 10 and a half minute per mile pace. And then I'll like adjust my data screens on my watch so that on my way up that hill, I can quickly look down and see how fast I am traveling up that hill. And if I wanted to keep, if it was one of those days where it has to be super easy, then you'd sort of cap yourself at a certain pace. But like I said, RPE is something that I also like to use, just like keep it easy. Most of my running is easy, around a 3 out of 10 RPE, rate of perceived exertion. And when I run up the hill, I need to keep to that 3. And usually in order for me to keep that 3, I need to really back off and get really slow. You can use power as well as a metric. I'm about to release an episode in a few weeks' time talking to a researcher about power. And I have since got a power meter and am using that a little bit. But if you do have a power meter or a foot pod that gives you real-time data of your power, that could be really nice going up the hill. You can use heart rate, but heart rate's very delayed. Yeah, all those sorts of things can help you dial in to make sure that you're not overloading yourself and keeping to certain parameters when it comes to the hills. And then if we've got the right balance, or you think you've got the right balance in terms of days per week, how hard we're working on our deliberate hill training days and how easy we're taking it on our other days, we just fall back to listen to your body, see how you're overall tolerating it. When it does come to uphill, we're looking at paying particular focus on the push-off muscles. So looking at the calf, the Achilles, sometimes the plantar fascia, when running uphill. We just want to make sure that any soreness, stiffness, tightness, next morning stiffness or soreness, overall level of fatigue throughout the week, we want to make sure that they're recovering and, you know, your body's, you're listening to your body and your body's telling you that we're hitting the right balance in terms of challenging, yet we've got that recovery to balance it all out. If we're like, it doesn't all have to be uphill, because sometimes the downhills can be quite tricky for people. So the downhills, we're looking at things like your, the outside of your hips, sometimes your knees, sometimes your shins, the ITB, people can get quite nasty ITB friction syndrome from doing too many downhills. So you want to listen to your body in those domains and those particular areas to see if you are doing quite well. But like you said, Rachel, even just general fatigue can be a sign that you're doing too much and that you need to make some adjustments. So that's some advice. Then just look at long-term trends. So yes, we're monitoring our symptoms. Yes, we're doing that sort of day by day, week by week. But then we're, you know, maybe taking two-week blocks. Am I generally, is that fatigue dissipating? If not, we can also fall back on other things that we can do. Maybe we sort of adjust some training frequency. Maybe we look at the distance that you're running. Maybe we reevaluate the speed that we're running up the hills or the RPE or those other metrics. Maybe we have to substitute it with some cross training. Maybe we need to do some cycling or elliptical or swimming or something like that to substitute. We can enhance recovery or at least assess recovery. How's your sleep? How's your nutrition? Those sort of recovery metrics. I know for me at the moment, training for High Rocks, which is 3 months away, the last week or two, I've had to, you know, not push myself, kind of hit like a maintenance or like a stable or slightly back off my training regimen just because I haven't been feeling great. I haven't been injured yet, which has been really nice, but just my sleep has been really affected this week, just with Mackenzie just having a few issues overnight or just waking up quite early. So at the moment, she's waking up around about 5:40, and we usually get her out of her cot at about 6:30, which means I'll need to get up and do my workout before getting her up and then before starting work. And so my mornings have been about 5:15, 5:30 at the latest. And sometimes if my sleep doesn't go well, say if I'm woken up once or twice overnight, or if I go to bed slightly later, then, you know, I'm sort of at my limits of what is adequate sleep and what isn't. So a couple of nights of not getting quite adequate sleep. And so I've recognized, you know, my body feels pretty good, but my head and my like just general sort of tiredness, just recognize I'm not getting the sleep that I require. And so have made the deliberate decision this week to still train, but just not push myself, just take it quite easy, just preventatively. You know, I'd be kicking myself if I stubbornly trained through progress and then got injured. And like, yeah, I sort of expected that. I would have saw that coming. So just being a bit more preemptive. But back to your question, Rachel. So yes, assess your recovery, make those necessary decisions. And then we can always fall back on if it is something that is quite a long term of an issue, and hills will always continue to be an issue. Look at strengthening the calves. I'm pretty sure you're strengthening your calves already, but just for those who are looking at find themselves in a similar scenario, doing some weighted bent knee calf raises or traditional calf raises and just getting quite strong with those, doing that twice a week. If it's the uphill that we're struggling with and we need to get stronger at, it is the calf muscles that we need to particularly strengthen. The soleus, the deeper one, the deepest of the two calf muscles will be biased better with bent knee calf raises. So, you know, we can work on that as well if all else fails. But I think everything that I mentioned earlier will be probably the primary adjustments that or primary considerations before then considering all those other things. So hopefully that helps, Rachel. We have Katya just quickly chiming in here to let you scholars know I have just updated my 5-day injury prevention challenge. This is one email per day for 5 days, learning new concepts and diving into the science on how you can reduce your risk of injury. The sign up link is in the show notes, so fill in your details and I'll be waiting for you in email number one tomorrow. Who submitted her next question and says, currently marathon training and my left hip hurts, especially right under the greater trochanter. So the greater trochanter, if you're unfamiliar and you're just standing and you bring your feet together, it is the most outer bony part of the hip. It's sort of like you've got your iliac crest, which is like the where your where your belt goes, that bony prominence, but it's further down, it's further towards, it's, you know, the femur, that bony sort of prominence is there. Katya continues, it started 2 to 3 weeks ago and wasn't consistent, but now I had to end my last long run early. I feel it with every step. It hurts getting from sitting to walking downstairs, especially the elliptical seems fine. Cairo thinks it might be IT band. Any idea what it could be and how to modify things? London is 30 days away. The London Marathon, she is mentioning. Thanks for submitting your question, Katya. Like I say, I'm not going to diagnose or, you know, attempt to know what's going on with the limited information, but I would say the most common diagnosis or the most, you know, frequently seen diagnosis in that particular area would be like a glute medius tendinopathy. There are a lot of muscles around that greater trochanter region and they all attach onto that common site, and there's a lot of hip external rotators. There's your glute medius, your glute minimus, your glute max, and all those sorts of things. And yes, the ITB sort of has, is in that general vicinity as well. But there are also things like bursa, which are like fluid-filled sacs that can get inflamed sometimes, and they can be present around that area as well. The ITB, which the chiro thinks it might be, it can be proximal. So the ITB just runs along the outside of your thigh and attaches just past your knee. So it travels all the way down your knee, and it's at the knee location, which is where the ITB mainly acts up most commonly. ITB friction syndrome is what we call it. And higher up, it can become irritated higher up, but it's less likely that does happen. But regardless, Katya, and anyone who's listening, regardless of your injury, if you are injured, I'd like to follow a few steps. So step one is kind of learning from mistakes. Katya, you mentioned that it wasn't that constant. It's only been 2 or 3 weeks, but then you did your long run to the point where now it hurts, or you can feel it with every step. Learn from our mistakes. That was probably too much. You probably ran too far, too long, and now you're getting symptoms quite constantly. So we sort of try to learn where those limitations are. So we can learn from that. We can sort of learn from also what caused it in the first place. Was it, were you ignoring the early signs? Was it maybe just training too much, maybe running too hard, maybe not getting enough recovery, maybe, not following a certain plan, or maybe the plan was too aggressive, all those sorts of things. So just bear that in mind. We want to try and learn so we don't repeat the same mistakes. Step two, I would say, trying to establish how much we can currently get away with, particularly when we've got a race that's coming up that, you know, some runners are like, I have to do this race. It's a must. Let's see what we can do. I'm okay to take on the risks and suffer the consequences afterwards. We now need to, think to ourselves, okay, with this injury, how much can we tolerate? How much can we get away with? How much can we sort of build up, whether that's cross training, running, strength training, all those sorts of things, to preserve as much fitness or build as much fitness as possible, yet still get you to race day, still get you through the race with a minimal amount of damage. So that's our next step. We have to try and work that out. And cross training is a good option, especially if our running is particularly problematic. It might be necessary with this race so close, we might need to say, okay, let's do a whole bunch of cross training, get really fit with a substitute cardio alternative that doesn't irritate symptoms. So with you, Katia, you said that the elliptical seems fine. I would say for lateral hip issues, that would probably make sense because there's less, I guess, compression is what we call it when we have those sorts of that angle, especially if someone's running with a narrow step width and there's a lot of load and force that goes through the lateral hip at contact when impacting the ground. So cross trainer is the feet stay a bit wide, or like the elliptical, the feet stay quite wide and there's no hard hitting of the ground. So if we remove those, then symptoms can be fine. And it looks pretty similar to running. Like you can, if we can bump up the resistance and you can maintain and preserve a lot of running fitness by doing the elliptical. So that would be a good choice. When we are running, I would say avoid downhill running, especially for the lateral hip. We're just amplifying the ground reaction force when we do run downhill. So if there are hills around and a downhill is unavoidable, then we would walk that particular segment. But conversely, I'm just assuming here, particularly with impact, like aggravated by downhill, those sorts of things, sometimes running uphill can actually be better. So we might actually trial just doing more uphill. So run the uphill, walk the downhill, and see if that's a really good option. See if that you can get away with more without symptoms. And if that does really well, like I've seen people do flights of stairs. You were saying that walking downstairs hurts, but maybe running upstairs is a good option. So we could try, back in the early days, I was interviewing stair runners and they sort of run upstairs and then catch an elevator down or an escalator or something and then, you know, repeat. That could be amazing for injuries that are aggravated with hard thumping downhill, because when you run upstairs, it's lower impact. The range of movement's different, so sometimes the range can irritate a particular injury and we are avoiding that particular range when running upstairs. These are options, like I say, trying to preserve and maintain and build upon fitness without irritating symptoms, so that could be an option. Also, just some run-walk intervals on the flats. This is all trial and error, as it should be with anyone who's injured. Just give it a go, see what symptoms are like, see what symptoms the next day are like. If it falls within acceptable limits, then we'll deem it successful and then continue in that direction. So there are a few options. So that's step two. Step one is learning from our mistakes. Step two is trying to establish what we can get away with. Step three would be daily modifications outside of running and outside of training to help settle symptoms. So commonly for lateral hip pain, we're looking at avoiding low sitting, avoiding crossing legs, avoiding like lying on that side, like sleeping on that side. Sometimes sleeping on the other side with a pillow between knees can be really helpful. Just those sorts of things so that we're avoiding irritating it outside of training. So modifying daily activities. Step four would be like after the race, how long does it take for symptoms to settle? Like if symptoms are ongoing after the race, then we might need to look at maybe strength training, strength rehab, maybe strengthening the hips and the glutes and those sorts of things. My guess is by the time this episode comes out and by the time, Katia, you listen to this, it's probably, you know, 3 weeks away from race day, which probably isn't enough time to build strength and say, okay, let's get stronger for this race. But maybe we consider that after the race just to make that whole area a bit more robust. So doing some strength training, you know, whatever, again, trial and error is probably required, but like some crab walks or some squats or some deadlifts, those sorts of things could be really helpful. Maybe we look at changing how you run. It's probably a last resort because I'm assuming it's not how you run that's contributed to the injury, because it's probably more to do with training volume. But we can look at cadence. We can, if your cadence is really, really low, there'd probably be justification for increasing that cadence. And then again, if symptoms persist even beyond that point, we might look at really getting things back to basics. We might really look at peeling things back and starting just with a walk, run, couch to 5K type of scenario and just see if that's tolerated. And who knows, you might even, as a last resort, look at getting scans, because there might be, we might have an ultrasound and the ultrasound might show, hey, there actually is an inflamed bursa. And if there is an inflamed bursa, then an ultrasound-guided corticosteroid injection can be really, really effective. I'm about to, it's going to be in about 4 or 5 weeks' time. I talk with a tendon researcher and we talk about corticosteroids, and a lot of people are very nervous about corticosteroids, but that's in the context of a tendon. If you have a tendinopathy, we don't like doing injections or corticosteroid injections into the tendon, but this would be different. Like in this scenario where they find it is actually the bursa that's causing pain, bursa is not tendon, and corticosteroids work really well with bursa. So maybe, like, I'm just throwing hypotheticals out there, but could be something that could be effective. Thanks for your question, Katya. We have Ryan, who submitted another question and asks, what is the most common diagnosis for glute tightness and soreness that lingers for months? Can run on it to a point, but then will be sore after. Okay, thanks, Ryan. Common diagnosis for glute tightness and soreness. I would say, you know, piriformis syndrome is a diagnosis that's kind of like, it's a syndrome, meaning like it's a blanket of symptoms that people just label as piriformis syndrome. But the piriformis is like a external rotator that sort of moves horizontally along your glutes and sort of attaches onto that greater trochanter that we mentioned earlier, and can become irritated sometimes, can become fatigued, can become tight, can become just irritated. And the piriformis has a very close relationship to the sciatic nerve. It sometimes runs, the sciatic nerve runs behind the piriformis as then it runs down the leg. And sometimes if the piriformis is irritated or tight or fatigued or something, it can impede or obstruct or entrap or, you know, just affect the conduction of that sciatic nerve and causes radiating symptoms. Some people have a genetic variation where the sciatic nerve is actually piercing through the piriformis rather than tucked in behind it, and they have an increased likelihood of developing something like a piriformis syndrome. But I'd say with this, like the other characteristics, pain characteristics, yes, it can be glute tightness and soreness. That's definitely some a cause of symptoms, but when it is aggravated and it's when it's at its worst, it often radiates pain down the leg, usually radiates pain into the hamstring, the calf, the foot, the toes, those sorts of things. It's made worse with trying to stretch the piriformis, or it's really, really tender to touch that particular area. So that can be a potential diagnosis, but the other one, which I see a lot more often, is proximal hamstring tendinopathy. Most people be aware, some people aren't, that I do have a second podcast called the Overcoming Proximal Hamstring Tendinopathy Podcast, just looking into helping people with this particular diagnosis. Very, very often misdiagnosed as piriformis syndrome, because while it is affecting the hamstring and the tendons that attach onto the sit bone, it does attach very high up into the sit bone, which sort of radiates or emits some symptoms which people can interpret as glute pain, because it is attaches so proximal and so like deep into the glute kind of region. So that is what I most often see. And like I say, it could be misdiagnosed and tried to be treated as piriformis syndrome for a long time, doesn't get better until the person suffering with it eventually comes across this diagnosis of PHT, proximal hamstring tendinopathy, starts treating it like a PHT, and they get significantly better. As with a tendon, it can have a warm-up effect. So Ryan, you're saying that you can run on it, but then it's sore afterwards. Can be very classical for a tendon to have a warm-up effect where during the run it feels better, or at the start of the run it's a bit niggly, but then once you've warmed up, those symptoms feel a lot better, but then comes back with vengeance after, later in the day, the next morning, those sorts of things. Speed work really disrupts this particular condition. Some people run too fast. People develop this condition by doing speed work that's beyond their capacity, and they just do too much too soon, and then they start developing this tightness that's really, really high up in the hamstring. And sitting really irritates people, really bothers people if they have PHT. So that's another, I guess, pattern of symptoms that might lead to a potential diagnosis. There are, like, in rare cases, some people can have like a bone stress injury or a bone stress fracture of sorts to the ischial tuberosity, like to the actual sit bone. It would be like worse with more loading, so it'd get worse and worse throughout the run. It would be like sort of achy at night sometimes, as is characteristic with some bone stress issues. When it is really severe, like if that particular condition does develop and the pathology develops to where it is quite severe, then weight bearing, loading, that even just standing on one leg can be really problematic. The other last one that I can think of is probably like ischiofemoral impingement. So I've done a recent episode on ischiofemoral impingement on the PHT podcast, because it is a very closely related, it's a different diagnosis that has very, very common symptoms to PHT and needs to be treated quite differently. It is essentially like two bony ridges. So you're looking at a bony ridge from the femur and a bony ridge from your sit bone. Those two bones can come quite close together and start to impinge a lot of the sensitive structures that are in between those two bones. And so extending the hip backwards, particularly passively, because if it's active, then it grips the hamstring and sometimes PHT symptoms can develop. But if there's a impingement test that therapists can do, but they essentially get you lying on your side, so your affected side is facing upwards, and then they just cradle your leg, so you're not doing anything, and they just extend your hip backwards. And if that produces symptoms, then that's a likely characteristic of this impingement, because nothing else is activating, nothing else is going on. We're just getting those two bones, moving them closer together. If it pinches and reproduces your symptoms, we can have some confidence in that that's a likely diagnosis. Hopefully that helps, Ryan. Hopefully it helps everyone else that's listening, just learning more about these particular conditions. We have Sarah, who's submitted the next question, who says, what is your return to run plan for those who have taken an 8-week break from running due to PHT and adductor tendinopathy? I've been cross-training with swim, bike, walking during time off, and been lifting heavy for 4 weeks. Okay, thanks, Sarah. A lot of people that listen to the PHT podcast listen to the Run Smarter podcast and vice versa. So hence, I do get these PHT questions that filter in. So what I would do is I would start conservative. My return to run would be very conservative, especially if you're returning from an injury, because we want to sort of mitigate as much risk as possible. And the only risk we have of starting conservatively is underloading you initially, which is not a big deal. That is not a big risk. If we don't go conservative and you overload yourself, like I say, sometimes with tendons, we don't know until afterwards if we've done too much because of that warm-up effect. And so the risk that we have of running and saying, oh, I feel great, let me go a little bit further. Oh, I feel great, let me go a little bit further. And then you're just limping afterwards and hobbling the next day. That risk is a major setback in your recovery. So I would much rather underload someone and then they feel great the next day. And we say, fantastic, next time let's do a little bit more. And so that risk of underload, when coupled with gradual progressions, will eventually hit your adaptation sweet spot and then you progress beyond that. But that's not really what runners want to hear. Usually the slow, patient approach isn't in a runner's wheelhouse, but that's why I'm here. I'm here to put some guardrails on people and guidelines to mitigate the risk of a flare-up. So what I would start with is probably a 1 minute run, 1 minute walk, and probably do that 10 times. If that elevates symptoms, it's not a huge dosage, it's not a huge amount. So even if that was too much, then you may be sore for 24 to 48 hours, but then we'll learn from that and our next approach will be a little bit more conservative than that. So yes, 1 minute on, 1 minute off. If you wanted to, you can substitute that 1 minute walk with some sort of cross training. So if you are at the gym, you might want to do 1 minute of jogging on the treadmill and then 1 minute of the elliptical or something of that effect. But if that particular dosage is successful, then I would continue to build. I would build till we're doing about 15 rounds rather than that initial 10 rounds of 1 minute on, 1 minute off. So in total, we're doing about 15 minutes of running. Then I would swap the ratios out and I'd do 2 minutes of running, 1 minute of walking, but I would do 8 rounds. So if it's 8 rounds of 2 minutes of running, we're looking at 16 minutes total running. So previously we did 15 minutes of total running. Now we're doing 16 minutes of total running, but the ratio itself is switched. We can build that up to 15 rounds of 2 minutes on, 1 minute off. So that's 30 minutes of total running. Then we can switch to 3 minutes of running, 1 minute of walking, and do that 10 times. So we haven't changed the total amount of running. We have just swapped the ratios and so on. And we'll just gradually build up. Usually if someone can build up to 40 minutes of a walk run plan, I would then start to incorporate some continuous running. So it might look like 3 minutes on, 1 minute off, 5 times, and then 10 minutes of continuous running after that. If that's successful, then we reduce the amount of run walks, we increase the amount of continuous, all keeping really, really slow running, trying to limit the amount of hills, trying to keep consistent with the shoes that you're wearing. So we're just not changing as many variables. If injuries are present, if injuries weren't present, I guess, if Sarah came back with the same question being like, I had 8 weeks off and now want to do a return to run plan, but there hadn't been an injury, I would say we probably don't need to be as conservative as that. Especially when we would factor in other bits of data. So we would say, we try and just get a good snapshot of how fit and capable and strong we think this person is to then see how, where their starting point should be. We can use information like their running history, because some people might take 8 weeks off, but they've been running for 20 years. They've done 2 marathons every year for the last 10 years. They're a very, very experienced runner. We don't need to be as conservative with that person. We would look at their injury history, we'd look at their current strength, what they've done in the last 2 or 3 months in terms of strength training or other fitness stuff. They might have done a lot of cycling or a lot of CrossFit or a lot of, swimming, who knows. But we gather this data to then be like, all right, where do we think their starting point is? And sometimes it's not as conservative as what I was just explaining before. But if you're returning from an injury, and we do have this really conservative start that I like to do, cross training helps. I know, Sarah, you're saying that you're doing swim, bike and walking and all those sorts of things. So that's going to be very helpful. Strength training definitely helps. So it says you've been doing 4 weeks of heavy lifting, which is amazing. Well done. And just trying to, what I would call, fit out your rehab ladder. So your rehab ladder is like your strength and rehab progressions and your cardio progressions and everything that's like one step at a time, progressing as a ladder does. But the top of the ladder is your goal. So your goal might be return to running. And every little step along that rehab ladder is designed to adapt your body to meet the demands of running. So if you were taking 6 weeks off or 8 weeks off and you've spent the whole time swimming, it's, yeah, so you're probably very fit, but swimming looks nothing like running. There's no loading involved. There's no, like, that range of movement's very different. The cardiovascular aspect is a bit different, but just like the load on the body is very different. So we can't expect you to go straight into running and expect to be that successful with it. We want that rehab ladder to include the challenges and the stimulus that mimics running. So it might not look like running initially, but then we might do some cross training. Then we might do some box jumps. Then we might do some like jump rope skipping, and we might do some lunges, and then we might do some walking lunges, plyo lunges, like all these sorts of things that then start to meet the demands of running. And so then when we have a really nice fitted out rehab ladder and we've worked our way through our ladder, then when it comes to the walk running, we're mitigating a lot of those risks and we don't need to be as conservative. So that really helps as well. When it comes to the PHT specifically, keep everything really slow and try to avoid hills, try to avoid running uphill, especially initially. I'm not saying, you know, you can never return to these things, but when building up your volume and seeing what's successful or not, speed really, really affects this particular injury. So keep it really, really slow and yeah, avoid running uphill. For the adductor, Sarah, because I know you said you're trying to come back from this adductor tendinopathy as well. I don't really think adductors really are influenced by running that much. Yes, we would look at speed. I think running at top speeds, the adductors tend to kick up. But it's mainly like team sports, like pivoting and changing direction, which we're not really doing that much as runners. So I wouldn't worry that much about that. But thank you very much for your question. The last one we have is from Denny. And Denny says, my lower back to the right hurts after running or after just standing for 20 minutes. More like it feels stiff. I don't have a particular question, but I guess if you could share some thoughts on lower back pain when running, that would be great. All right, thanks, Denny. And I would initially like refer you back to one of my older podcast episodes. I managed to find it. It was episode 283. The title is Managing Low Back Pain in Runners. I'll attempt to, you know, spill my thoughts here, but I would encourage you to go back to that because it's a lot lengthier, a little bit more detail. So yeah, usually like you can use, first of all, you can use like your podcast directory as kind of like a search engine. So when people ask me about certain questions on, you know, our Facebook group or like on YouTube comments and those sorts of things, I generally like to point them to an episode. And I usually just type in the search bar in the podcast section. I usually type in the Run Smarter podcast, and then I'll type in knee pain, or I'll type in plantar fasciitis, or I'll type in this case, I put the Run Smarter podcast back pain, and this episode just popped up. And so you can use it as a bit of a catalog, but also I have the Run Smarter app where if you download the app, it's for free, and then you go to, I'll do it now. If you press the app, you then have you have different titles. So you would click on the one that says podcast, and right away you have a list of certain categories. Because I've tried to take every episode I've ever released and put them into different categories. And so I have some on injury prevention. I have some on specific injuries. If you click on specific injuries, there'll be injuries above the knee, injuries around the knee, and injuries below the knee. And if you click on the certain folder that says injuries above the knee, you'll get ones on hamstring, you'll get ones on lower back pain. Just looking at it now, episode 4 of this list, myths around low back pain with Dr. Kieran O'Sullivan. So I've interviewed him in the past before. A fair bit of hamstring stuff, but that will definitely help. So if you wanted to do that, you know, if anyone has any injuries or wanted to look for specific topics, the Run Smarter app is there to do that. Okay, so lower backs are tricky because there can be a lot of different structures and a lot of different diagnoses that go on. If you say that it's on one side and not, say, down the middle, I would say, you know, it could be ligament, it could be a facet joint sprain, it could be just muscle spasm of sorts. If you're saying it feels stiff and that it's sore after standing, I would say it's probably something to do with maybe a facet joint that can get particularly stiff, and maybe that facet joint is being getting tighter or jammed, or don't really want to use the term jammed, but when you run, that can definitely happen. So my thoughts are, like, usually, because most of the time for runners, lower back pain is okay. Like, most people don't really suffer from low back pain because of running. Yes, a lot of the general population have low back pain, and some of those people in that general population are runners, but it's not usually influenced by running. So what I would inquire, if you do feel like it gets really stiff when running, is just do some mobilization exercises before running and see if that makes a difference. The other thing you could just do is go to a physio or a healthcare provider and then see what structure is involved and what you can do for your running to help. If you really think it is because of your running, maybe I'd look at your running cadence to see if that's particularly low. Maybe you're running quite inefficiently. Maybe there are some unnecessary ground reaction forces that are, you know, rippling their way through your lower back. And if you find your cadence in more of an optimal range, that might help. But doing some mobility exercises beforehand, then go for your run, see if it feels better, could be a good test that you might want to experiment on. If you look up cat-cow stretches or cat-cow exercises, that can be nice to mobilize the lower back. I like to do these, like, knee rolls from side to side. So you lie on your back, your knees are bent with your feet still on the ground, and then you just rock your knees from side to side. This isn't like a stretch and hold type of stretch, it's just rocking. Then I like to bring my legs up in tabletop, so hips and knees are up at 90 degrees, and then I rock from side to side and then go for a run. I'd probably do one set of 15 in each direction and see if that helps at all. That's my attempt, but like I said, there's a lot of structures that are influenced around that. Maybe we need to do some lower back strengthening or some core strengthening or something to that effect, but I'd give that a go first and see if it makes a difference. So thank you, Denny, Sarah, did I miss someone? No, Denny, Sarah, Ryan, Katia, and Rachel for submitting your questions today. I will be back next week with more questions coming up, so look forward to bringing you those. I love doing these Q&As. I should do it more often, but like I say, this list gets long, and I hope, even if these particular questions don't resonate with your particular situation, hopefully you've learnt a lot. So as I sign off, remember, every new insight brings you one step closer to your next running breakthrough.
If you are struggling to overcome an injury, you can jump on a free 20-minute injury chat with me, which you can book through my calendar in the show notes. While you're in the show notes, elevate your running IQ by jumping onto my free email list so you can receive material to help rehab your injury, lower your injury risk, and increase your performance. If emails aren't for you, consider my Facebook group, Instagram, and YouTube channels. And remember, each insight you get from these resources brings you one step closer to your next running breakthrough.